Before I was interrupted, I was introducing our speaker for the morning, Mr. Olson. He has spent almost all of his life in northern Minnesota and northern Wisconsin, and is one of the foremost naturalists in our nation. He was head of the biology department at Ely Junior College in Minnesota for quite a while, and has traveled extensively throughout his travels, and primarily in his concentrated work in the area of naturalists and biology in northern Minnesota. He has written numerous magazine articles and such books as The Singing Wilderness, The Lonely Land, Runes of the North, books of this nature. I think that each one of us, if we had the opportunity to just read one of these books, would see the great value that Mr. Olson has given for us. In the experience which he has gained, he has also gained a great deal of prestige as one of the foremost naturalists of our nation, has served as president of the National Parks Association, has been on the National Advisory Board on the National Parks and Monuments, and just recently has become a consultant to the Secretary of Interior and Director of the National Park Services on Wilderness Preservation. So I think we can look forward this morning to a wonderful speech by Mr. Olson on wilderness and the space age. Mr. Olson.
I'm very happy to be back in the Twin Cities. Even though your temperatures are way down compared to what they were in Washington, I'm always happy to come back to Minnesota. I'm a dedicated Minnesotan, and no matter where I go, it always seems good to get back here. I'm a little apprehensive this morning because I see a number of knitting needles flashing, and I can't help but think of the women knitting around the guillotine at the time of the French Revolution. I hope there's no connotation in this. If there is, bear with me, and I'll do the best I can and try to escape out the back door before your fury is aroused. I enjoyed your program up to now. I thought the personifications were excellent. And I thought your queens, I think your queens are beautiful. They're going to have a hard job picking, I'm sure. When I was asked to come to McAllister, I accepted with a great deal of joy because it would bring me back here. I also accepted with joy because I've heard some very fine things about McAllister, your scholastic achievements. McAllister is becoming a name in the educational world, and you should be very proud to be in the student body here. I was also glad to come because your president gave me the choice of talking about a subject which means a great deal to me, and which I think will mean a great deal to you and does mean a great deal to you. It's a subject that we cannot avoid, a subject that's tied up with our culture and the kind of living space we're going to have during the rest of your lifetimes and in the lifetimes of those to come. An old Greek philosopher said a long time ago, life is the gift of nature, but a beautiful life is the gift of wisdom. All of us want to lead beautiful lives, but it takes wisdom in the space age to lead a beautiful life. More wisdom than the human race has ever needed before. I think the beautiful life is tied up very closely with our environment, the places in which we live. It's very difficult to live a beautiful life in ugly, unattractive surroundings. You young people look forward to the day when you'll be off on your own and supposedly living beautiful lives. You're making the decisions now which will determine where you're going to live and how you're going to live. There are many things that dictate what a beautiful life is, and I'm not going to attempt to cover them all. Attitudes towards life, spiritual beliefs, educational background. I want to talk about only one, and that's your environment. I'm an ecologist, and an ecologist is a study, or one who studies the relationships of animals to their environments. In the last analysis, the only study really worthwhile in ecology is the relationship of man to his environment. So from an ecological standpoint, I want to survey briefly man's relationship to his environment. There's nothing more important than to be adjusted to the place in which you live. About a century ago, and almost 2,000 years after the Greek made his important statement, there was a man by the name of Henry David Thoreau who lived in Concord. And he said this. He said, "In wildness is the preservation of the world." He said that 100 years ago, when Concord was still wild, when most of the continent hadn't even been explored. And when people heard him say that, they thought he was a little bit off the beam, so to speak. If Thoreau were alive today, he would realize the truth of what he said. He said another very interesting thing, speaking of the village of Concord. He said, "The salvation of this little village does not depend upon the righteous people who are living in it as much as it depends on the swamps and the woods surrounding it." Again, the pronouncement of a crackpot, so to speak. But even that is true. The amazing thing about this man is that he said these things 100 years before anyone else had any idea of what he was talking about. Now Thoreau is probably quoted more than any other American writer. Thoreau was the man who influenced Gandhi. Thoreau has influenced countless men all over the world. And what he said then has depth and weight today. Our space age, which we talk about so glibly, is a strange age. It's an age full of dynamic and vital happenings. One only has to look at it to realize that man has come a long, long way. When I flew in from Washington yesterday and landed at your new airport here, made it in a couple of hours of flying time, I couldn't help but be impressed with what we have done in the annihilation of space, what we've done in able to move about the earth, what we've done in the matter of sound and smells and our environment generally, what we've done in the matter of scientific achievement. Just think what we've done. Telstar, missiles, anti-missiles, satellites. We're actually planning on going to the moon, and I have no doubt but what we'll place men there. We're drilling a hole in the Pacific to find out what the inside of the Earth is like, the Moho. We're changing the face of the earth with our gigantic earth-moving equipment. We're changing the courses of rivers. We're going to change ocean currents. We're going to control climate. We're controlling disease. We're going to be able to synthesize life. Within the last year, scientists have already come a long way in this. And I'm willing to predict that it won't be too long before we string together the proper nucleic acids so that life can be produced. We're going to synthesize chlorophyll too, just the way the British scientists have synthesized milk. We're on the verge of so many astounding scientific achievements that it's baffling, to say the least. And no longer surprising, our inventive genius is absolutely unpredictable. Look at what happens sociologically. All these emerging new nations. The end of colonialism. Alliances for Progress, economic federations. I attended the first World Conference in Seattle in July. There were some 70 nations represented. Very exciting to speak to all of these people from all over the world and to realize that they're groping with the same problems that we have, the same problems we had after the revolution to weld their governments together. With all these emerging ideologies, shifts of emphasis, shifts of ideas, no wonder man is a little bit baffled by the space age. And then to compound the thing, we have an exploding population with a possibility of 300 million in these United States before the end of the century, possibility of 6 billion in the world before the end of the century, and all of its concomitant problems. We have an expanding industrial base, expanding industrialization of every country in the world in the offing. All this has had a terrific impact on man. And man is beginning to wonder what the solution is to this. Whether he has wisdom enough, as the old Greek philosopher said, to live in spite of all of these things, a beautiful life. He's beginning to question and wonder where he's going. An ecologist, in addition to surveying the present environmental demands of any creature, including man, has to go back and look at his beginnings. Well, let's look at us. Man has been on this earth as Homo sapiens probably a million years. As we know Homo, probably not more than 100,000 or two. It's lengthening out with the explorations going on every year. During most of this time, man lived a primitive life. Hunting, fishing, surviving in spite of the elements, living close to the earth. Only during the last 40,000 years has he left any record of a culture, and by culture I mean stone implements, pottery, sherds, that sort of thing. Only in the last 5,000-6,000 years has he left any written pictographic record of his history. And still during all of this time he's lived close to the earth. Up to 100 years ago, Americans lived close to the earth, and the way of life of the bulk of Americans had not changed. But now it's changed. The bulk of Americans live in cities. They live in urban complexes. No longer do the bulk live in the country, and it's going to be increasingly that way. We are recently emerged from a frontier which left its mark on us as a people. Some of your grandparents are still alive who remember migrating to this country or the Middle West. We're so close to the past we can almost hear the rumble of wagon trains as they headed west. It isn't far back, it's close for us. And that frontier, early settlement, early farming experience left its mark on us as a people. We're still close to the earth. We're still very close and very dependent on it. As an ecologist, I know man is no different from other animals. I look at you, and I know that within every one of you is a collective consciousness of the race. A collective consciousness in which all of your primitive experience rests and is stored. That collective consciousness we carry with us in spite of the miraculous age in which we live. I also know that adaptations and adjustments don't happen hurriedly. They have to take time. Adaptation sometimes takes thousands, hundreds of thousands, or millions of years. We are asked to adapt suddenly from a rural, primitive way of life to a space age where we live away from the soil, where things are happening which never happened to man before, and we're expected to make those adjustments overnight. I believe man is not quite ready to make that swift adjustment. He's doing the best he can, and he's trying, but deep within him are still the need of the old primitive environment from which he sprang. An environment that has a certain timelessness about it, an environment which had a certain beauty about it, a harsh environment that required physical effort for survival, an environment which certainly was simple compared to the complicated lives we are living, an environment that had, in which there was time to think and contemplate and survey the world in which man lived. There's an editorial in the Washington Post the other day, and the title intrigued me. The title was "A Place to Catch a Lizard." A young boy of 7 living in California had written President Kennedy, and he said this: "Dear President Kennedy," he said, "there's a little gully below my house where I go to catch lizards. And there's a big road going through there, and when the road goes through, there won't be any more lizards. Can you do something to stop this road from going through this place so I can still catch lizards?" Well, I don't know what President Kennedy wrote him, but he turned it over to the Washington Post, and the editor of the Washington Post wrote this editorial. And I thought in that editorial was the whole substance of this matter of preservation of our environment. This boy wanted to keep a place where he could catch a lizard. All of us want to keep places of beauty and simplicity, places we've learned to love. We want to keep them forever. There's a challenge before us to try and keep these places. The government has embarked on a sort of a crash program to set aside more national parks, more wildlife refuges, more state parks, more reservations of all kinds which will protect the American scene. There's an urgency about this because with our population explosion, with the spread of the urbanized complex we call the urban sprawl, these delightful places are being gone, they're being gobbled up very swiftly. It may not be a place where you want to catch lizards, but it may be a place where some wildflowers grow. A place of beauty where you've been wont to come and stand and be quiet for a while. Those places are worth preserving. And it's toward that effort that our government is now trying to do this while there's still time. I don't think there's probably more than 10 years left to do this, because land is disappearing at an astonishing rate. And unless these places are preserved, our environment will be changed forever. And it'll be more and more difficult to find a place in which your lives can be lived beautifully. Bertrand Russell said not so long ago, and in spite of his attitude on ban the bomb and his marches and willingly going to jail for this, that, and the other, he said some very wise things. Speaking of our inventive genius, he said this. He said, we can do anything we want to do, seemingly. But our big task in the future is to gain wisdom rather than more cleverness. We are clever enough, but we yet have not gained the wisdom to know how to use that cleverness. We are bemused by machines. We are bemused by the things that we create. But we are not gaining perspective and wisdom. I think one of man's greatest needs is to gain perspective. The kind of perspective where you can put the results of our inventive genius in its proper place, where we can live in an environment which is a place of beauty and from which we can survey what we have done. None of us would contemplate going back to the primitive and giving up what we had wrought. That would be ridiculous. But I think it's possible to bridge the gap between the past and the future, and perhaps gain this type of wisdom which will make our lives more beautiful. You're no doubt saying to yourself, well, what has this to do with the preservation of wilderness and natural areas? It has a great deal to do with that. Because of our background, because of our collective consciousness, because of our feeling for the earth, it has to do with the protection of our environment. The great historian Trevelyan said, we are children of the earth, and removed from her, our spirits wither. Nothing truer was ever said. We are children of the earth. We're close to the earth. And if we don't get a chance to put our feet on the earth, every so often, if we don't have an opportunity to look into the distance, if we don't have a chance to see wildflowers and animals moving in freedom, or if we lose the opportunity to really enjoy the outdoors, uncluttered by man-made things, we are losing touch with the environment which gave us birth. I don't think any of us are so blasé and so sophisticated or so urbanized that we can say within us, I've gotten rid of all that. I don't have to depend on a countryside or an environment. This is good enough for me. But you cannot deny your birthright. Psychologically, physiologically, you are at one with the past, and you must respect your heritage. Another Greek philosopher said, and it's amazing that they said it then, because there was so much wild, unknown country. He said, let's protect our silent sanctuaries. This was in Greece. For in them we perpetuate the eternal perspective. I think this generation must throw its weight behind the protection of our silent sanctuaries. I would hate to see an America where there was no more living room, where all of America was an industrial complex. Heaven knows we need industry for our economy, but I think we can have both. I think we can also save our environment to the point that wherever you live, it'll be a pleasant place in which to live. Luther Gulick, the great city planner, on a panel on the urban sprawl in Washington, said not long ago, the urban sprawl has gotten out of hand. We must correct it. In our future planning of cities, we must have recreational opportunities for many, contemplative opportunities for a few, but glimpses of beauty for all in the complex of our urban development. Glimpses of beauty for all. 60 years ago in Washington, President Roosevelt called a meeting of the governors of the states to consider conservation. It is a long meeting, and the proceedings are tremendous. You can find them in the Library of Congress. I never hoped to read them all. But I was looking through that vast amount of testimony not long ago, through parts of it, and I ran across a statement which, to me, I thought was the most beautiful thing in that whole conference, where conservation actually started in America. This man's name was Horace McFarland, and towards the close of the conference, he got up and he said this. He said, gentlemen, for over 100 years, we have done our best to make America ugly. He said, let's devote this new century to making America beautiful. Says patriotism depends on loyalty. No one is loyal to an ugly country. So in our work, let's remember, if we are to build loyalty, patriotism, and love of country, let's keep America beautiful. Minnesota has a great future. It's a very unusual state with a diversity of terrain which is delightful. I think in Minnesota, we must do everything we can to preserve little places as well as large places, where beauty will always be available for everyone. The preservation of places where people can go to find serenity, to gain perspective, to look forward into the distance and backward into time. I sometimes think these places are islands of refuge, islands from which modern man in the space age can gain perspective. I was on a radio program with Justice Douglas in Washington a few years ago, and he said something that I shall always remember. We'd made a hike down the Potomac of about 189 miles, I think it was, just to demonstrate that the Potomac could be saved as a recreational region. We were on radio several times en route. And he said this. He said, we create sanctuaries for ducks and geese, deer and mountain lions. Isn't it time we created a few sanctuaries for men?